Kansas gets a new governor next week. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, a conversation with Governor-elect Laura Kelly. Kelly takes office on January 14th, ushering in a new administration and possibly a new era in Kansas politics. Governor-elect Kelly met with Jim McLean of the Kansas News Service at Washburn University in Topeka on December 14th, 2018, to talk about her priorities and challenges as she takes office. This event was co-hosted by Kansas Public Radio and the Kansas News Service.
I imagine you've been it's just been one endless budget meeting after another. Really, what are your days filled with these days as you get ready for this transition?
Well, we're really focused on two things. One, putting the budget together. That's absolutely essential. And I've been working with some terrific people in the Division of Budget, and then many of you in the audience know Dwayne Gosin, who was the budget director under Governor Graves and the budget director under Governor Sebelius, and he is helping me put that all together as we go through the transition. So I expect we'll have it done on time, and we'll give it to the legislature as soon as we get into session. The other thing we've been spending a lot of time on is really looking all across the state of Kansas and beyond to find the best and the brightest folks to bring in here to put in charge of our agencies, most of which need a lot of work.
And you've promised a bipartisan cabinet. Is that what you're working on?
Well, I think you can just look at the transition team. You know, we named our team leaders, and, you know, we've got Dwayne Gosin, who worked for both a Democrat and a Republican. Natalie Haig was Governor Graves' general counsel and chief of staff. And then Joyce Haligrucci was Governor Sebelius' chief of staff. So I don't think you can get any more bipartisan than that.
Do you have any reaction to some news that just occurred today? Your friend, Senator Barbara Boyer from Mission Hills, switched parties. She became a Democrat, left the Republican Party. It's been rumored for quite a while. I know she's been thinking about it for quite a while. You probably had some advance notice. What do you make of that?
Well, for those of you who don't know, Senator Barbara Boyer is a senator from Johnson County. I think she was in the House first and then came over to the Senate a few years ago. And I worked very closely with her when she was vice chair of the Health Committee, and I'm ranking minority on that. So we've had a very close working relationship for several years now. And yes, I did have advance notice, but I also know what a hard time it was for her to make that decision. You know, party affiliation is often like your religion. And it's very, very difficult to go through that process and decide that it's time to make a change. So I'm delighted that she's there. I think she will be able to have a louder voice because she will be put into some very significant positions. And she can use her expertise. She is a retired physician, mm-hmm. For instance. And so she'll be able to use that expertise again now that she's in the Democratic caucus.
And for those who don't know, she was stripped of her committee assignments earlier in the year because she endorsed a Democrat in the 3rd congressional race. And then later on, she appeared in an ad for you. So the die was cast after that for sure. But she'll probably take your ranking position on the Health Committee.
Nothing's been announced yet, but that's a likelihood, yes.
I think there'll be others. Is she the only one? We're in the midst of a bit of a shift here post-election. Do you have advance notice of anybody else?
I don't have any advance notice, Jim, but nice try.
Would you tell us if you did?
No.
All right, we'll try again later. You know, you made a lot during the campaign. I think the word you used over and over again was the devastation done to Kansas state government over the last 8 years. I mean, everybody knows we've had revenue problems in the state, right? And so you're now sitting in these budget meetings, and you're getting a pretty deep dive on all the agencies. And you're getting a firsthand look. I mean, you already knew some of this because you were on the Ways and Means Committee for so long, but you're getting a firsthand look, really, at the state of these agencies. And what are you learning? Anything really surprise you about what you're learning in terms of the state of state government?
I wouldn't say that there were any surprises because you're right. I mean, for the last 8 years, I've been the ranking minority member on the Ways and Means Committee. So we have reviewed all of the budgets and all of the agencies over that time. And it was very apparent over all of those 8 years that slowly but surely we were just decimating our agencies. We've been cleaned out. I mean, you go over to the Kansas Department of Transportation now, it's like a ghost town. The same thing over at Revenue, the same thing over at Commerce. And I think everybody's fully aware of the problems that we have in the Department of Children and Families. We have within our mental health system, within our Department of Corrections. So no surprises, but I am disappointed that the devastation is even worse than I thought. And it's going to take a long time to put Kansas back.
Do you think Kansans really have any appreciation of that? I mean, we're going to talk about issues here, and you certainly are going to have initiatives, things that you're going to want to do. But just how much fix-it work do you have to do? And do you think Kansans really understand how much of that needs to be done just to get back to a certain capacity in state government?
Well, I don't think anybody can know how bad it is until you actually get in there and do the deep dive. And that's part of what our transition team has been doing, you know. Beyond the three folks I talked about in leadership on that transition, we then have people with lots of institutional knowledge from all of the various agencies across the state. And they created small teams, and they've been going in and really doing the deep dive to see where the issues are.
In terms of looking at vacant positions and just, priority positions that you have to
who's
fill.
Who's in positions, qualifications for those positions, vacancies, certainly. Programs that have been eliminated or inappropriately funded. I mean, just all of the kinds of things that one will find when they do a top-to-bottom, essentially audit of the agency. And, you know, we said this all through the campaign, that the problems are broad and they're deep. And we are going to have to approach them, you know, sort of like you would a triage. You know, we go after the critical, the most critical first, and then we prioritize all of the others. And so we will, you know, we've said we would, and we will focus on education, making sure that we're meeting the constitutional requirement to fund education. And we will look to expand Medicaid, and then we will also look at infrastructure. And because we are actually literally in a life and death situation in DCF, they'll be very high on the radar scene. That's Department of Children and Families, the foster care system.
Yeah, I want to go back and touch individually on each of those issues, but first, you know, I want to talk about a bit of a structural question, because, you know, any repair work that you need to do, any initiatives that you have in mind, you're obviously going to have to work with the legislature. You talked about governing in a very bipartisan fashion, and what you have really is a legislature that has three roughly equal factions. You have conservative Republicans, you have moderate Republicans, and you have Democrats, with the conservative Republicans basically holding pretty much all of the leadership positions. And, you know, how much they decide to cooperate with you is going to, I think, make a big difference in terms of what you can get done. And as I told you, we'd been talking to some legislators about how they might work with you. We did that on the day that they had leadership elections at the State House. And we want to start with a cut of Dan Hawkins, who from Wichita, who's a Republican, who's the new majority leader of the Kansas House. And we just asked him about working with you, and this is what he had to say.
She's not a stranger to the process. She knows that the governor gets what we send her. You know, so the governor-elect can say a lot of things about what she wants, but ultimately it's what comes out of these two bodies that she gets a chance to either sign or veto. And so I would say that laundry list that she has out there, probably not going to be fulfilled in entirety.
Any surprises there?
No, I know now Majority Leader Dan Hawkins very well. I've worked with him for a long time. Previously, he was chair of the House Health Committee, so
right.
I've interacted with him a lot on a lot of different issues, and obviously we were the ones at the negotiating table during conference committee. So I know Dan, and I believe that we will be able to work together. And, you know, he said, I won't get everything I want. Of course not. You know, that's... You know, it's all about reaching consensus and compromising. So I think we'll be able to do that.
Have you maybe you've had private conversations with Dan and Speaker Reichman and the others, but what signal was he trying to sound or send there? What did you make of that? anything? I mean,
well, remember, he was running for majority leader in the House, so I think he was trying to send the message that he would be a strong leader for the majority in the House. Mm-hmm. And I think he will be. But I also know him well enough to know that you know, he wants to do the right thing. And when it's all said and done, you know, I won't get my way all the time, but I think Representative Hawkins will work with me.
And you've worked with these people before, and you think you can work with them, notwithstanding the political posturing, which is to be expected at this point, right?
I think so. You know, I have, over the 14 years I was in the Senate, you know, there were times that I was forging compromises with the moderate Republicans. Occasionally, it was with conservative Republicans. So we'll just go down that road. And you said we're evenly divided in thirds. But what we always did in the legislature until we went through the years when all the moderates were ousted, mm-hmm. Is always the moderate Republicans and the Democrats worked together,
right.
and formed what we called the moderate majority. And I think we've got that. Still available to us in the House and the Senate.
The governing majority, moderate Republicans and Democrats, somewhat smaller, though, than it has been, was last year, for instance.
This is true.
Right?
But we won't have to override vetoes of important legislation.
You may have to sustain a few.
Huh?
Right?
We do.
All right. Well, let's get to a couple of specific issues, because school finance in particular, I know that was a priority of yours in the campaign. We've had this seemingly endless litigation over funding public schools. You said during the campaign that you were going to meet the constitutional requirement to fund schools, get the Kansas Supreme Court to sign off on that, and be done with this lawsuit once and for all. Last year, you all appropriated some $520 million over several years, and the court came back and said you needed an inflation adjustment in there, which is what, roughly an additional $90 million a year, something like
that? It's in the ballpark.
Right. And so I think you're heading into the session, right, just thinking you're going to get that done? Is that your intent?
It is my intent to get that done. And we'll be able to do that without raising taxes. There, you know, if you remember, a couple of years ago, we overturned the Brownback tax experiment. Mm-hmm. And what that did was allow revenues to start coming back into the state coffers and put us on the road to recovery. And we continued down that path. And, you know, we had very good news when the consensus revenue estimates were done, which is really wonky, but that's when they tell us how much money we can expect. And they increased that by over $300 million for the next 6 months. What that does is it gives us money in the ending balance to draw down to take care of the school finance problem without breaking the bank and with being able to fund some of the other priorities.
Right. A lot of pent-up demands. And so the estimates you talk about, roughly $900 million ending balance based on current spending. And so you've got some money to work with there. But on the school finance issue, just in the last couple of days, Representative Hawkins, House Speaker Ron Reichman and Senate Majority Leader Jim Denning were talking to some educators over in the Johnson County area, and they said that they're not sure we can afford this additional $90 million, and they want to go back and rewrite the law you passed last year. So what does that mean in terms of how easy this is going to be to get this this thing settled?
Well, you're talking about the school finance plan that we passed.
I am.
And what they're talking about is wanting really to rewrite the school finance plan, and then they will accompany that with an attempt to get a constitutional amendment to remove the court's authority to tell us whether we've met our requirement to fund education. So, you know, I think, one, we will find when the budget comes out that indeed we can afford it, and two, I think most people, all Kansans perhaps, are really tired of having this issue in the court and want it gone. And we have the money to do that. And I think to not do that would be incredibly irresponsible. And I think most of the legislators get that, too.
So are they staking out this position on the school finance bill as a bargaining chip for the constitutional amendment they want? I know you oppose that. But as governor, again, with the divisions in the legislature, might you have to compromise on something like that to get the money you want?
I may have to compromise on things to get other things that I prioritize, but that won't be one of them.
The constitutional amendment specifically.
Exactly.
You're going to oppose that no matter what.
Yeah, well, you know, actually I have nothing to do with it as governor. When you think about it, you know, that will go through the House, it'll go through the Senate. If it makes it through both of those chambers, then it goes on the ballot to the people. The governor has no sign-off one way or the other on the constitutional amendment, so I will leave it to the legislature to address that issue. But this will hardly be the first time this has been brought up.
Right.
It has always had a very hard time getting through the legislature because it requires the two-thirds majority. And then on the rare occasion when it did, the people of Kansas said no.
Yeah, in your estimation.
They wanted the court to maintain its duty to provide for the separation of powers and the checks and balances that the court provides to the legislature.
You know, in order for that to even be a good bargaining chip within the legislative process, they have to have the votes to threaten to pass it, to put it on the ballot. And I know in recent years they haven't. What is your estimation now as to whether they do or not, given the slight changes we've seen in the legislature?
You still don't get to the two-thirds majority.
Okay.
I don't think. You know, obviously, we haven't counted all the noses yet, but I don't think that. But if in the end they are able to get it out of the legislature, I have no doubt that the people of Kansas will reject that.
Okay. You mentioned before that we have a little more money to work with. The consensus estimates, the revenues now are coming in above projections. So are money problems as a state, are they behind us? Are they over?
Oh, I wish. No. They're better. They're far better. It's always nicer to have more money coming in than the original estimate, but by no means, Jim. You know, I said before, there is money to take care of some of the really critical situations that we've got in our state. It will take, you know, more years of growth and when I say growth, I'm not talking about raising taxes. I'm just talking about the economy just growing.
Right.
And we will be doing some things in this administration that will stimulate the economy, like funding education. And so we need some steady years of growth. And as that revenue comes in, we will have that priority list of issues and concerns, programs that need to be put back in place.
And that is what I wanted to talk to you about. As money becomes available, you know, what are going to be your priorities in what order? And we know funding schools will be one of them. You mentioned Medicaid expansion a minute ago. The cost estimate there is kind of all over the map, but at least $70-some million, maybe more than that, in additional state spending. Is that something you have on your list to do early, or do you think we have to wait?
No, with Medicaid expansion, what we're doing is really going to bring together some folks and look. There are a whole bunch of different ways you can do Medicaid expansion, and there are different models now that other states who did expand Medicaid have in place. And so we'll be reviewing those to see which ones work, what doesn't work, and what's doable within our budget constraints.
That's right. You're talking about putting together a task force, a committee of some sort, to come up with a Kansas-specific expansion plan. Is that correct?
We do want to put together a very specific plan for Kansas, and okay. We will have some folks who know what they're talking about, you know, looking at what the other states are doing and figuring out how we modify those and bring those to Kansas.
Is that something that's going to be ready to go this session, or do you know yet?
I hope that we have it ready to go.
And you think you've got the votes. That's going to happen finally?
Well, remember, Jim, that 2 years ago we did pass Medicaid expansion.
You did.
And
the governor vetoed it.
Governor Brownback vetoed it. And we were not able to override that veto, but we were only 3 votes short in the House. And so I know that there have been some changes. I think there are some folks who've come into the House who will be maybe would vote to sustain that a veto like that. But I don't think you can get to the two-thirds majority.
Let's move on to another issue, because it's pretty clear that you have some things that you want to spend money on immediately, but you also want to be very cautious until you really understand whether our revenues have sufficiently recovered and will continue to be robust in the out years, because those consensus estimates you mentioned actually show us, you know, based on some variabilities, you know, having a deficit by 2022. So you have to be cautious about that. And one of the things I think the Republican leadership is very interested in doing right off the bat is the return of the so-called federal windfall. When the federal government made those tax changes, it had an impact on some state taxpayers who could no longer deduct certain things. And so they're very eager, I think, to get a bill, that return of the windfall bill, on the move early in the session. And you have expressed some concern about that. Let's listen to Representative Stephen Johnson from Assyria. He's a Republican chair of the House Tax Committee. This is what he has to say about why this is a priority for Republicans.
This was a tax increase last year that I feel we did not intend. So we'll see if the legislature agrees with that, if the governor agrees with that, if we get a bill to her desk.
And he's a reasonable guy, but the price tag for that is something like $90 million. And so what's your position on that kind of right out of the gate?
My position on that is the same as my position has been throughout the campaign regarding taxes. You know, we still do not know, Jim, the full impact of what we did when we overturned the Brownback tax experiment, adding to that what the federal government did. And so I think we need to let the dust settle on all of this, and we will know better at the end of this year. Well, and when I say this year, I'm talking fiscal year,
right?
Which would be July 1st. We'll have a much better idea then of what the full impact of both of those moves have been. And it's at that point that we could start talking about modifications to the tax structure, but not before.
But won't this be a pretty big political football right off the bat? I mean, you heard a little bit in Representative Johnson's rhetoric, but Senator Tyson the other day, you said that we could do the things that we need to do immediately without raising taxes, and a lot of the Republicans are going to say this is a de facto tax increase. I mean, are you ready for that rhetorical battle?
Well, we already battled that one last year, you know, and
on the last day of the session, yeah.
I mean, that actually did pass in the Senate and then got tied up in the House. 59-59 tie, it takes 63 to pass a bill, and so it died. So we've had that conversation. We've had an election, and I think the people of Kansas spoke loudly. They tend to like the approach that I want to take, which is fiscal responsibility, and being very conservative about what we do right now, because we don't know. We don't have all the data.
So where do you think the moderate Republicans that you'll need to hold the line on that? Where are they on this issue? Do you have any idea at the moment?
Well, I do. Just given how they voted last year, I have a pretty good sense of where they are.
Okay. And so you talked about wanting to be cautious with the revenues and really understand exactly where we are in terms of this recovery that's underway. But there is a long list of pent-up demands. The supplemental bill the other day was about $1.3 billion over the next couple of years. You've got highways, you've got the problems you mentioned with the foster care system. You've got a lot of people talking about wanting to lower the state sales tax on food. We're among, if not the highest in the country on that. What are your priorities in terms of the limited amount of money that you want to spend immediately to rectify some of those things?
Well, education, you know, is number one. Medicaid expansion, though we might be able to design that in a way that's pretty much revenue neutral, will be first, and then foster care and the Department of Children and Families would be third.
Yeah, what's it going to take there? Do you have any idea yet after the meetings? This is something where we try one thing, there's a new secretary, there's a hue and cry about children sleeping in offices and a lot of tragic cases where kids were in abusive homes, were not removed, and were injured or died at the hands of abusers. There have been lots of stories like that, so it's pretty clear, and foster care numbers are going up and up and up and up and up. So do you even have a handle on what the problems are? Or how multidimensional is it?
Well, I do have somewhat of a handle.
We're
learning new things every day. But I served for a year and a half on the Child Welfare Task Force, and we did a pretty deep dive ourselves in what the issues were there. And actually, the task force just came out with about 24 recommendations, I believe, that will be presented to the legislature and to the administration in January. So we'll be able to take a good look at that. I already know what they are, but we will look at that as we're figuring out how we're going to modify our approach to foster care in particular, but the entire child welfare system.
Some research has indicated recently there's some connection between some of the changes the Brownback administration made in eligibility requirements for some welfare programs, TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, and the food stamp program, and the foster care numbers. And you've indicated that you'd like to roll back some of those eligibility restrictions that were imposed. How much of a priority is that for you?
It's a priority. We actually, this interim, I also serve on the CanCare Oversight Committee, and that committee recommended that a bill be introduced that would roll back TANF eligibility requirements to pre-2011, which is when we started to really double down on those programs. So that I see as the starting line for the legislature to have the conversation, because clearly it's the legislature who will have to make those decisions. Part of what we've done over the past 8 years is that we took what had been in rules and regulations, so the agency actually had some flexibility on eligibility, but we codified all of that. So all of these really, really stringent restrictions on both the temporary assistance for needy family, child care assistance, and SNAP is now in law. Mm-hmm. And so it will take the legislature going in and making those changes, but we will provide, well, they will be provided with the baseline.
But you're going to make recommendations specific to those things to the legislature?
Yeah, I think it's important. It'll be part of our solution to the problem at DCF with foster care, because you're right. I mean, KU did a study that showed a direct correlation between the changes that we made to TANF eligibility and the number of kids in foster care, which in the last 8 years went from having about 5,000 kids in our system, which is a lot, but now we're over 7,500.
And it continues to grow.
Yeah, and it's not just the changes in eligibility, but there's a direct correlation with that.
We're going to go to audience questions in just one moment, but one more political football to dispense with here. One of the things that you've also talked about prior to taking office is this controversial adoption law that was passed last year. You talked about we're looking into the possibility of maybe not enforcing it. Are you still thinking about that?
Thinking about it.
Okay.
I haven't done anything about it yet. I don't have all the information that I'm going to need to decide if we can even do that, or if that's something the legislature will have to do.
Yeah, and one of the legislators we talked to, and this will be no surprise to you, Representative Susan Humphreys, who was instrumental in getting this thing passed last year, this is what she had to say about the prospect of perhaps not enforcing that law.
That's absolutely an abuse of that power. The reason we put the law into place was to protect the child placing agencies that are faith-based. We don't want to lose any of those. To say that they now can't operate doesn't have the best interest of children. I think we're already at odds as it is, so I don't really know what would happen.
And just for a little bit of background, conservatives say the law is needed to protect faith-based organizations that do adoption, to protect them from state rules that could force them to violate their quote-unquote strongly held religious beliefs. But others, including you, Governor-elect Kelly, have said that the law expressly allows discrimination against LGBT Kansans, which is why you're looking into it, right?
Well, it is. I mean, and there's nothing that we would propose that would prevent those child-placing agencies from working with the state. It would just prevent them from discriminating and getting any state funding to support that.
Okay.
You're listening to Governor-elect Laura Kelly speaking with Jim McLean of the Kansas News Service. This conversation took place at Washburn University on December 14, 2018, and was co-sponsored by Kansas Public Radio and the Kansas News Service. Coming up, Governor-elect Kelly takes questions from the audience right after this. From the University of Kansas, this is Kansas Public Radio. We're 91.5 Lawrence and 91.3 Olsburg Junction City. Get your Tiki Freak on Saturday night, February 23rd at Maselli's in Lawrence. That's when KPR's Retro Cocktail Hour presents the exotic sounds of the Tiki Torches in concert. Sponsored in part by Dr. Stephen H. Chronister, DDS, Healing Smiles of Topeka. The doors open at 7 o'clock. The music starts at 8, Saturday, February 23rd. Ticket information is at retrococktail.org.
Support for KPR comes from 715 Restaurant at 715 Massachusetts Street in downtown Lawrence, featuring local handmade food, diverse wine list, and craft cocktails for lunch, dinner, and weekend brunch. More information at 715mass.com.
I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, a conversation with Governor-elect Laura Kelly. Last week on KPR Presents, we reviewed the election that got her here. It was the Dole Institute of Politics post-election conference with campaign advisors, political strategists, and journalists dissecting the 2018 elections for Kansas governor, as well as the 2nd and 3rd District congressional races that brought Charisse Davids and Steve Watkins to Washington, D.C., where they were sworn into the 116th Congress this past week. If you missed that or another KPR Presents, you can find most programs archived at our website, kansaspublicradio.org. Laura Kelly will be sworn in as the new governor of Kansas on January 14th. On December 14th, Kansas Public Radio and the Kansas News Service co-hosted a conversation with the governor-elect. This event was moderated by Jim McLean. Governor-elect Kelly now takes questions from the audience at Washburn University in Topeka.
I'll kick it off here with this one from Sheila and Rick Gardner, who are asking how gun laws can be tightened.
Well, hello, Sheila and Rick. I can't see anybody, but glad you're here. We have probably the least restrictive gun laws in the country. And I think that, and I've always been a strong supporter of the Second Amendment, and I will continue to be, but I think even people like me who support the Second Amendment believe that we need to reinstate some common sense regulations within our gun policy. And actually, we've taken some steps towards that. Last year, we voted to allow for folks who have domestic violence violations to have their guns removed, or convictions, rather. And we also allowed for public hospitals, public mental health centers, public adult care homes to restrict gun carry on those facilities. So, and we've come very close on some other things like campus carry and whatnot. So I believe that there will be continued efforts to just put in place common sense. And my intent is to really bring together folks, the stakeholders in this, so your educators, your mental health folks, law enforcement people, and have them help me craft common sense gun policy, and then work with the legislature to get as much of that done as we can.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, this is something you're interested in bringing a group together to craft something around whether some consensus about maybe what to do, and once you have that, then you would go forward, and that may not be something you do immediately.
Well, we can put the group together immediately, you know, and that will always be something I have to work with the legislature. And so as soon as we're ready, we will do that. But I'm not sure how quickly we can get all that policy put together and then line up the votes.
Okay. Another question.
So you've talked about abused and neglected children. We've got a question here from Stacey Jeffress about abused and neglected adults. She says there's a backlog at KDADS of uninvestigated abused and neglect and exploitation allegations. So how will you be addressing abuse and neglect of adults in the state's care?
You know, that's one of the things that we're looking at as we're drilling down into the agencies. There are so many of those kinds of programs, whether we're looking at the abuse and neglect of adults, of kids, look at our foster care system, but we also have nursing home licensing and all sorts of things like that that need repair. And we will be looking at ways that we can start making those things functional again.
Okay, Amy, we'll go back to you.
We've gotten a few questions regarding mental health resources, but this one specifically comes from Kayleen. And she says that as a teacher working with elementary school students with severe social and emotional needs, she is wondering how we can ensure that we are getting these students the adequate and accessible mental health services that they need.
Well, yeah, and just to let you know, I actually started my career in the mental health field. I worked with children with severe mental health issues in a state psychiatric facility in New York many years ago. I've also been working very closely with mental health advocates over the past couple of years, looking at ways that we could present sort of a comprehensive plan for mental health services, because it's a continuum of services from, you know, pre-prevention right through, you know, hospitalization and then discharge and everything that comes in between. And one of the things that I know I want to see happen what's happening right now is, you know, the development of regional inpatient facilities, including children's crisis centers, across the state. We will put a strong emphasis on making sure that those services are close to home. But the other thing I want to do is work with, and I've been doing this, working with our school districts and our community mental health centers, our safety net clinics, to find ways that we provide, you know, licensed social workers, licensed psychologists who are available 24/7, 365, but are housed in the schools when the schools are open. So we actually have a pilot program that will be starting up this year, and then I want to look at ways as we get this comprehensive plan put together to broaden that out across the state.
And Maddie Fox, before we move on the mental health issue, the story, Maddie Fox is a reporter for the Kansas News Service, the story you were working on today relative to mental health with the RFP that went out, do you want to ask the governor something about that?
I could. So there's an RFP, a request for proposal out at the moment for beds, regional beds, to bring some of the state hospital beds, so they're not simply in Osawatomie and Larned, which is their two current locations, put them out in the community. So hospitals or other facilities in Wichita or Lawrence could build some. Do you think that's a good avenue forward? And do you think that speaks to the sustainability of keeping mental health facilities in places like Osawatomie and Larned that have proven a little hard to staff?
Well, I do believe in the regional approach. I think it's important that we provide those services closer to home, closer to family, closer to work, so that, you know, the transition back home can actually happen. And family can be involved. You know, if you're 4 hours from Osawatomie State Hospital, the likelihood of your being involved in your loved one's treatment is very slim. Certainly not on a regular basis. So, I think it's important that we move services closer to home. I actually supported. We did put some additional funding in for crisis centers last year, and I supported that, and I will continue to support those efforts. As part of what I expect will come out when we put together a comprehensive plan. You know, one other thing I might add on mental health, because I really am a big believer in pre-prevention, so that we don't even need to get into, you know, the school health, is that I want to leave as my legacy a very robust early childhood program across the state of Kansas, and I plan to start working on that this year. By bringing together our educators, our mental health people, and our business community. I think the way we can actually afford to do this is by doing it in a public-private partnership. We actually have some model programs here in the state of Kansas that if we could broaden would make a huge difference. And what those programs will do for us is take those kids at a very early age, maybe even prenatally, work with them, work with their families. What the model programs are showing is that by the time those kids get to kindergarten, they don't need special education. And by the time they're getting to, you know, sort of the wonder years, they're not involved with the juvenile correction system. And I think we could see a reduction in mental health issues in our schools if we were to do a better job early on.
What children are you talking about there? What population are you talking about there, intervening with?
Well, I believe that early childhood education is good for everybody.
For everybody, right.
For everybody.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So we've got a number of questions about climate change and what Kansas can do as a state to conserve our environmental resources as we have them. This is from Justin Moss. Between droughts, floods, heat waves, polar vortexes, and severe weather, Kansans are already suffering from the effects of climate change. What actions can Kansas expect from your administration to address this?
Well, I think there are a few things. First and foremost, a lot of that's got to happen on a federal level. And so I will be a governor who will work very closely with our congressional delegation so that you know they recognize how important it is to Kansans that they address these issues on a comprehensive level. So that's one thing. I think then there also, I plan to be very involved with the Western Governors Association, and one of their real concerns are environmental issues and climate change. And so I want to learn from them if they've done things that have actually made a difference in their states, what we might be able to bring to Kansas. And then I think there's no doubt that we need to continue to grow our use of renewable energies. We've done a pretty good job over the past few years. And I think Westar reported a month or two ago, you know, that 35% of the electricity that they're providing now is via renewables. I think we need to continue down that path.
So Teresa Collins has helpfully provided me a follow-up. How do you plan to implement the Kansas Water Plan and protect the future of water in Kansas's aquifers?
That's a huge issue. Obviously, water is probably, it's one of the most critical issues in the state of Kansas. And Governor Brownback actually had a group of folks come together and put together a very detailed water plan, a 50-year water plan, which is sort of the way you need to think about water issues. The problem was that there was absolutely no funding, or very little funding put into it. So we've got to go ahead and address that. The other thing I want to look at, you know, right now we deal with water issues in probably 9 different agencies across the state. We need to figure out some way to bring those under one umbrella or close to one umbrella, so that we have all the stakeholders in the room working together and setting policy and implementation, you know, in a consistent, forward-thinking way.
Meredith Frey would like to hear your ideas for criminal justice reform that gives dignity to the inmates.
One of the things that we really need to do, and we plan to do, is work with the Sentencing Commission on guidelines for sentencing. Right now, we are incarcerating many, many people who are nonviolent first-time drug offenders. Those folks no more belong in prison than you or I. What they need, if anything, is treatment, and we've got to figure out a way to divert them from the correctional system. When we incarcerate those people for a first-time drug offense, you know, we're really separating them from work, separating them from family, and doing great devastation to them individually, but also, I think, our economy. We have a workforce shortage here. We don't need to be taking people out of it. I think those are some things that we will get to quickly. We also are going to look at our prison system. I think there are a lot of problems in the system. I've been made aware of them as I've served on the budget committee, and so we will be drilling down and again bringing back folks who know how to put things together in the correction system. And I also want to look at, I believe it's South Dakota, but don't hold me to that. There's actually somebody who's sort of one state that's really gone away from the punitive approach to a more rehab approach, and they're having incredible success. Recidivism is really, really low. And what they're doing is they're providing work, training, and treatment within the prison system, and so when those folks get out, they're able to reintegrate into the community.
I want to follow up on that real quick before we go to another question, because as everybody knows, we've had some problems in the prison system over the last couple of years, violence in the prisons in various places around the state, and there was some conversation about, in part, that was because of the way inmates were being moved around and housed and everything else, and you just indicated that we, quote-unquote, have problems in the prison system that you learn about as a member of the budget committee. Can you be more specific? I mean, what are the problems with our prison system? Is it overcrowding? Is it the mixing of prisoners? Is it the lack of the state's inability to hire correctional staff? All the above?
Probably all of the above, but I do think that we have severe staffing issues. at our correctional facilities. We know that many of them are understaffed, and you've got lots of folks working in a very stressful situation and being required to do overtime. It doesn't add to it, and then that leads to high turnover, so we're constantly looking for folks to take those jobs. So we have got to address that issue.
Okay. We've got time for a few more questions. I want to make sure that we get as many of these audience questions in as possible. So is it your turn, Maddie?
It is my turn. So Drew Rosdahl of Lawrence did his homework. He says Missouri and Arkansas, two red states, won by Donald Trump, voted in 2018 to increase their minimum wage. What lessons do you see for Kansas, and what level do you think is right here?
So Arkansas really did do that, huh? Good for them.
Good for Arkansas.
Well, because I know they got rid of their Medicaid expansion for all intents and purposes, so I'm glad they did something well. But, you know, I think during the campaign, I made it very clear that I think the minimum wage is ridiculously low. You know, there's no way you can work one or even two minimum wage jobs full time and support yourself or your family. So clearly that has to be addressed. And I think we might take, was it Amazon that just said they'll pay no less than $15 an hour? I think that's going to help us in that conversation because, you know, when you look at, you know, the competition for workers, we do have a workforce shortage. And so if we've got an employer the size of Amazon providing that kind of minimum wage, that's going to put a lot of pressure on other businesses to consider doing the same. And we will work with them.
Kind of a quick shift of gears here. During the campaign, immigration was a big issue. Your opponent, Kris Kobach, made that a big issue, particularly in the closing weeks as this caravan was moving its way up from Central America. And Governor Collier sent some Kansas troops down to help with border security. Are you going to keep them there?
Well, let me tell you that's a problem, and I actually asked about this. When you get elected, you go to new governor's camp. And
do you sleep in bunk beds
what?
And have roomies and all that kind of thing?
Or? Yeah, so almost.
Okay.
So, you know, we got briefed on a lot of things, including emergency preparedness, homeland security, and whatnot. And I can't tell you a lot about what we talked about in there, but one thing I learned was that the federal government preempts the state government on issues concerning the National Guard. So if they want, they can federalize our National Guard, and then they go under the direction of the president, not the governor. Mm-hmm. So that's.
So you attempted to tell the White House that if they want to keep them there, they need to federalize them?
Well, I think that might have already happened, but if it didn't, yeah, I'll be telling because no, I mean, I think that was just an optic and to make a point towards the end of the campaign. And I think, you know, I grew up in a military family, Jim. You know, I know what it's like to be left behind when your dad goes on assignment. And to do that to a family for no good reason. It's one thing when you're trying to protect you know, the United States. It's another thing when you're using it for political advantage. And so, no, I would never do that.
And one of the reasons I brought up is because immigration was a big issue, but it's also a huge issue for the ag community in Kansas, particularly Southwest Kansas. And you had it out with Mr. Kobach at the state fair debate over this issue. And then the Farm Bureau, which typically makes an endorsement in the governor's race, to the surprise of many, did not endorse the Republican nominee. And do you think that had something to do with it, his position on immigration?
Might have. I'll also tell you, though, that the Farm Bureau has endorsed me before in my state Senate races. So I think they recognize that I get it, and I appreciate and understand the importance of agriculture in our state. So it might have been just deciding that I was good enough. So, But, you know, the immigration issue, again, is a really a federal issue. We have got to have Congress put together a comprehensive immigration reform and get it done and get that off the table. You know, we've been suffering under this for the last 20 years. I was talking to President Farley just before I came in here, and he said the difficulty in recruiting foreign students to come in here into the United States at all, Washburn specifically, is very, very difficult. You know, that all of our universities, Washburn particularly, Fort Hays State, KU, K-State, Wichita State, have really recruited foreign students to come into the state for years, and their recruiting efforts are not going well now. People, those students who are some of, quite honestly, the best and the brightest in fields that we need, in healthcare and in technology, are going to other countries because we've been so unfriendly. And I don't want us to be unfriendly as a state.
We have time for just one or two more. I want to go back to the audience questions. So whichever one of you is up, go ahead.
So I'm going to back us up just a bit to agriculture again. Agriculture is a major economic driver in Kansas. How do we overcome the economic downturn in that sector?
Well, we get rid of the tariff discussion. That would help. Yeah, I think that's huge. The immigration issue is also huge. But one of the things that we did early on was put together what we call our Rural Prosperity Plan. And if you care enough, it's on the website, you can go look at it. But it's a very detailed and very doable plan that would have us working with our rural communities and having them, you know, sort of evaluate their assets and figure out ways that they can put things together so that they grow, you know, or make some very tough decisions. But I also think that the state needs to be a better partner with our rural communities. I mean, some of the things that we've done over the past 8 years have hit our rural communities much harder than any place else. You know, when you underfund the schools and they have to close, when you don't expand Medicaid and your rural hospitals close or on the brink of it, the impact on the economy there is huge. And felt very deeply. So I think, you know, as we go back and we start funding our schools adequately, we can get Medicaid expansion done, that's going to be a huge help to our rural communities.
And we haven't talked about highways, but highways are key to rural development and agriculture as well. The Brownback administration put 21 projects that were scheduled as a part of TWICS on the shelf. The task force that is meeting wants those 21 projects taken off the shelf and completed as soon as possible. Roughly $600 million worth. How quickly can you get to those?
Not by next Tuesday, that's for sure. That's going to take a while. But we're working with our communities on that, and we will. Yeah, we don't have the budget all done yet, but we will look for ways to ensure that we fulfill some of our promises that were made to these communities a long time ago. So, yeah, transportation, infrastructure, whether you're looking at highways, you're looking at broadband, are critical to our rural communities also. And as part of our rural prosperity plan, we will be addressing those issues.
You did promise during the campaign to four-lane that section of Highway 69 down in Southeast. So that's on the list of things to do, right?
Cute.
Well, you helped.
Actually, I will tell you that the next 11 miles is already in the budget, and they will be. Taking care of that in this fiscal year. So it's done.
The people of Southeast Kansas.
And that was not my budget. I'm not telling anybody what's in my budget, but I believe that the Department of Transportation found the money to go ahead and complete those 11 miles. They found the money. So I think that's in process.
But just to make sure, I mean, it is your intention to try to get these highway programs back on track over time?
Absolutely. You know, I've always been a major supporter of the transportation program. You know, I think it was 30 years ago under Governor Hayden, we put together the first comprehensive 10-year plan. And Kansas became a model for the entire United States. We had the best roads in the country, and we need to go back to that. It's, you know, when you look at education, healthcare, and transportation are probably the three biggest drivers of our economy. And they have all suffered the last 8 years, and we need to put them all back in place.
Your water glass is empty. I've made you talk a lot. Do you have time for one more question from the audience?
So again, a huge pile of questions here, and we'll make sure that the governor-elect has all these questions so that she can follow up as she sees fit.
If your question
didn't get answered. But one final question here from Mike in Topeka that I think is fitting note to end on, which is when your term as governor is over, and he has an asterisk here, no rush. So perhaps he means your first term.
You did pack the audience tonight, didn't you?
Say what?
You packed the audience. They're all your friends.
There you go. Four years from now, what is the one thing that you want to have accomplished, and how can we, or the assembled audience here, help you do it?
Re-election. No, I really do. I mean, I ran because I wanted to be in a position to help put our state back together. You know, it's always the way I was focused as a state senator. I wanted this opportunity to work with my legislators, work with the people of Kansas to put it back together. You know, I moved to Kansas about 32 years ago. My husband and I were living in Denver at the time we had our first child. And because I grew up in the military, I really wanted to put down some permanent roots. And so Ted and I thought about it and decided that we would come to Kansas. And so we did 32 years ago. And we came here because of the great schools. We came here because of the good job opportunities, and we came here for a quality of life that is surpassed by no other state. So I want to bring all that back for other Kansans, for future generations.
Thank you very much.
You've just heard Governor-elect Laura Kelly speaking with Jim McLean of the Kansas News Service. This event took place at Washburn University on December 14, 2018, and was co-sponsored by Kansas Public Radio and the Kansas News Service. Immediately following Governor-elect Kelly's conversation with Jim McLean, the Kansas News Service hosted a panel discussion featuring KPR's own Stephen Caranda, Celia Yopis Jepson of the Kansas News Service, and Professor Bob Beatty of Washburn University's Political Science Department. You can hear their entire roundtable discussion on our website, kansaspublicradio.org. But we'll finish out the hour with a quick reaction from Stephen Caranda, KPR's Statehouse Bureau Chief.
She called it triage in her budget, focusing on specific areas in the budget. So, you know, I've talked to her before, and she wouldn't even go as far as saying she wants to restore the cuts to higher education. So if you're someone who is looking at an agency in state government or a service in state government that you really want to see some funding this year, I would say don't get your hopes up unless it's one of those areas she talked about tonight, because it's not clear that we're going to see wide increases in funding. And I think when she calls it a triage in her budget, that really tells us that she's going to be focusing on some specific areas, and not everything is going to see restoration of funding this year.
That's Stephen Caranda, KPR Statehouse Bureau Chief. He was part of a roundtable discussion immediately following the December 14th event with Governor-elect Laura Kelly. You can hear the entire roundtable discussion on our website, kansaspublicradio.org. You can also find last week's KPR Presents, where we reviewed the November elections for Kansas governor, as well as the elections of Sharice Davids and Steve Watkins to the 116th Congress. It's the Dole Institute of Politics post-election conference on our website, kansaspublicradio.org. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.